Welcome to the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society. Welcome to ITSP Magazine Podcast Radio. You're about to listen to an episode of Tech Done Different Podcast with Ted Harrington. Do you follow the pack or challenge the status quo? Join Ted as he explores how to succeed by going against conventional wisdom. You'll hear leaders in technology and security tell stories about how they achieve their success by doing things differently. Knowledge is power, now more than ever.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Tech Done Different. I am your host, Ted Harrington, and with me here today is my good friend and fellow author, Lindsay, who is here to help us understand how to achieve greatness. And certainly, Lindsay, I'll let you introduce some of your own accomplishments, but I'm going to brag for you for a moment. But first of all, thank you for being on the show.
Oh, thanks for having me, Ted. I'm excited.
So, Lindsay, when I was thinking about my day today and thinking about the things that I was most excited about and stimulated by and like what was getting me energized, definitely this conversation with you is at the top of the list. So I'm excited about wherever we're going to take this conversation.
It could go lots of places.
It can. Yeah. So Lindsay, she'll obviously, you'll color out some of your experiences more than I will, but to introduce you to our audience, you are not just an Olympian, but a gold medalist. You are a number one bestselling author of the book Better Great Than Never. And you're here to help teach our audience that's largely around, technology leaders and security leaders about how they can think about pursuing their own sense of excellence. So maybe you could color out your own bio a little bit more than what I just did.
Sure. It's always funny because you think and you read things, and I'm sure we all do the same thing. You see something, you're like, is that me? That's me. Okay. I started rowing when I was 20 years old, and from the time that I was 20 until I retired from the elite level of rowing, I ended up a two-time NCAA All-American, three-time world champion, former world record holder, and Olympic gold medalist who, for that feat, when my teammates and I won Olympic gold, it was the first time any female athlete won gold in women's rowing for the United States at 2,000 meters. So they also put the nine of us in the Hall of Fame for that. And now I guess I've written a book and I coach and I do some other things, but that was the rowing part.
You're too awesome. It's just like, well, I still vividly remember. Yeah. When we were in Austin together a little over a year ago, and you just casually, it was like not even a big deal. You're like, oh yeah, I have this thing. And you pull out your gold medal out of your bag. So what's it like to carry around a gold medal with you? I mean, is it like a sense of pride for you, a sense of accomplishment? How do you think about that?
Two things. You get stopped in security all the time. You cannot go through airport security with that and not get stopped. So I always have to remind myself to take it out of my bag and put it, but the other thing is why I actually take it with me places is that for me, it's this thing, and it's weird to be around other athletes that have also, gone to the Olympics or won. And so you're like, what's the etiquette here? Should I take it? I don't know. But the vast majority of people have never experienced this thing. And so I love taking it places because I get to share it because it really represents possibility. Like I think of myself as this lanky girl that grew up in the country from Virginia. And then I was able to go to the Olympic Games and make Olympic history with my teammates. So it's bigger than the medal. It's bigger than us. It's the possibility that's within every single one of us out there.
So when did you recognize that possibility? I mean, that's a really powerful sentiment that at some point in your life, you recognize, hey, maybe I'm not this as you describe yourself, lanky girl from the country. There's an Olympian in you. How did you discover that possibility? And how can maybe people hearing us have this conversation look inward to themselves and say, hey, I have possibility too. How should someone do that? How did you do it?
Yeah. I mean, it starts with one day and one decision. Ultimately, part of finding where you do want to go is also knowing where you don't want to go and where you don't want to be. And that's really how it started for me. I mean, I was on this aimless wandering path where I had grown up playing sports, but then didn't think I was good enough to play sports in college. And so, you know, past high school. So I left sports behind. I gained 30 pounds. My grades went down. And ultimately, I ended up, you know, waking up in the middle of the night, wishing I weren't a lazy bum, you know, thinking, gosh, I wish things were different for me. And very serendipitously woke up the next day and bumped into the rowing coach when I was in college, 20 years old. And he said, hey, you know, you should try rowing. And because I was on a path that I didn't want to be on, that entered my life at that moment. And I said, well, I don't know where this could take me, but it could be pretty great. So I'll give that a shot. Why not?
So I'm hearing you say that it was, you were open to new opportunities, not necessarily knowing what those might be, and then following that path as you saw opportunity present itself.
Yeah. It wasn't that I woke up and thought, oh, I want to go there. I want to go to the Olympics. It was, you know, I want something different for myself than what this is. And ultimately, you know, going from where I was then to the Olympic Games was a one step at a time process. And I definitely reiterate that in the book, you know, that it's scary, that it's challenging, but that you have to remember every single day that it doesn't all happen at once, but like one tiny little thing, one little step at a time.
That's pretty cool. When one of the things, when I think about technology, right, and what it really inspires me about getting to exist as a security professional surrounded by all these, you know, passionate people in technology, one thing that really strikes me is that people in technology have this sort of relentless drive to not just make a difference, quote unquote, but to literally change the world, right? Whether they're themselves the entrepreneur who comes up with this new tech, or they are in a large enterprise and they're just, you know, making their difference within their realm of the country, of the company, it seems like everyone in technology is relentlessly trying to change the world and probably suffer from a lot of that same sentiment that you described, right? Where it's like they want to change the world today and tomorrow's too late. It sounds like you struggle with that a little bit, or struggled with that. What would be the advice to someone who's sort of wearing those shoes? How do you be patient?
Yeah. I mean, the more that when you're really trying to squeeze out those next bits, like when you want to go from one level to the next level, and then if you're really looking to, as you said, you know, change the world, like be that much higher, it isn't this massive jump that happens. It really is taking those tiny infinitesimal pieces and doing those things incredibly well, because that's what's going to squeeze out that, for us, you know, that millisecond of a difference. You know, everything that you've done up to this point where you are, it's been the foundation, you know, the platform, and it's not going to be this massive improvement that's going to happen at that moment. But from one day to the next, the tiny little piece, and it could be, you know, a simple connection with someone else, a pass on the street, a simple hello, you know, a simple hello changed my life. It could be the missing piece in your network that you need to get you to that next level. But the patience of it is, and even writing the book, I had to step back and think to myself, like, I'm writing a book about patience, about many things, but patience is a big piece of it. And I'm like, this doesn't happen. No one, you know, won a race because of some grand start. It's the whole consistent piece, some heroic thing in the beginning. No, you make sure that you stay energized that way too. If you drain all your stores right away, that's not going to do you any good in the long run. Stay nice and consistent with it. That definitely helps.
Yeah, I guess you're right. Yeah, they say that you can overcome a slow start, but you can't overcome starting too fast.
Yeah, because you put yourself in that hole, you know, and even when you're very excited about something and you pour all of your energy into it, because I've done it myself, you know, this is me. I'm really, you know, and maybe a month or two in, you just get really tired. And that level of energy and the amount of effort that you need to be able to put into that thing, you don't have because you spent all your chips too early. So staying a little bit conservative initially, like, okay, this is going to take a long time. And sometimes teammates help you with that. Coworkers help you with that to literally say that to you. Take a step back, because this is going to take a lot longer than a month. This is going to require long-term energy and, you know, making sure that you're taking care of yourself in that process. That's what's going to allow you to succeed in the long run.
This reminds me of when well, this is not at all on the same level of athletic performance as your life. but when I was, I trained to run the, I ran the Boston Marathon a few years ago. And I remember in training for it, everyone was always talking about, you don't run the marathon on marathon day. You run the marathon in the 6 months and many hundreds of miles training for marathon day. And then the race day is just the culmination of all that effort. It sounds like that's sort of what you're saying, right? It's the putting the work in every day, day in, day out, so that you can squeeze that millimeter of performance out on race day. Is that a correct interpretation of what you're saying?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that our coach said to us, you know, the first World Championships that I ever went to, we were so prepared. We'd done so much more than my teammates and I, that is, than we had ever done in our entire lives. And we lost big time. And so the very next year, though, we turned it all around and broke the world record. So within a year's time of being demoralized, you know, to the next World Championships, we won it, set the world record. And in between, our coach brought us together and he said, you know, one of the key things that I remember him saying was, preparation is confidence. You know, confidence is something that a race can crush instantly. But every tiny little day, those tools that you put in your toolkit, one tiny little step at a time, gradually build your confidence so that on race day, it is that culmination of all those things.
I've heard you talk about the idea of overtraining before, and it sounds like that had some really adverse impacts on your own athletic career and even just your own, it sounds like maybe even some of your mental health in terms of like your own satisfaction with everything that was happening. I think that in technology, especially those same types of people who are so driven to try and change the world, there's this sort of martyrdom, right? Of like working all the time, no sleep, no rest, no relent. What do you say to those people about the importance of rest and the downsides of, you know, overtraining? And by the way, if I framed any of your perception overtraining wrong, please correct me.
I mean, it is what it is, right? Overtraining, you are doing too much. Yeah, that's actually the topic that I want to cover in the second book that I want to write, you know, because it's incredibly important. With overtraining, what happened to me from a physical and in the athletic realm was that I just did too much too soon. And my body wasn't ready for it. And the first things that started to happen weren't physical issues. They were mental things. I started withdrawing socially. I found myself depressed for the first time in my life. I wasn't as energized. I was irritable. I would snap at people. I wasn't as talkative, as you can tell. I'm talkative, you know. So I just thought, gosh, something's wrong and I don't know what it is. And it was an accumulation of stress. And interestingly enough, you know, that ended up leading to injury and, you know, self-reflection and all of that. The same thing happened in work life after I retired from rowing, where I was in school full-time, working full-time, recruiting, you know, all just too much. And even though those were mental stressors, the same cascade occurred in me and where I went, oh my gosh, I've been here before. I don't want to do this again. So making sure that you're taking care of yourself physically and not overextending physically allows you to be better for other people and the things that you want to produce. If you're taking that for granted, any second, you are going to be less creative. You're going to be less communicative. You're going to be less of a team player and therefore less productive.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And if you take that, and it sounds like some of the things you've talked about are different pivots throughout your life, you know, into being an athlete, into being an elite athlete, out of being, you know, you're still an athlete, but you're no longer competing at the elite level, and now you help people in other ways. It reminds me of this exchange that I had recently with a chief technology officer who I so admire the way he was so brave in sharing this. And he shared it in not a public forum, but a private forum, but there were multiple people in this forum. And he shared about how frustrated he was with the company that he's running. And the company was just, it's really struggling financially. They weren't doing well. And he personally was struggling financially, but he had this commitment to the customers that he did have. And how does someone like that, who's working themselves to the bone, the results aren't producing, how should they evaluate their situation and maybe think about it differently?
Mm-hmm. A piece of that is I would first look at the people around you, look at your team. Something that I've believed through this whole process and then now also as a coach is that every individual component within that team individually can be quite fantastic at what they're doing. And you can be productive to a certain extent. But when you're able to connect with others around you and allow other people to be the best at that piece of it and this other person to be the best at that piece of it, then your combined effort is going to help you become so much more productive. I know from a leadership standpoint, that's incredibly hard to do because that requires trust. You're trusting that someone else is going to do this piece of whatever the project is that you're working on, whatever your aim actually is, that that person is not only capable of, but that you trust them to produce what you personally might otherwise be producing. But again, I mean, that scalability, right? There are only so many things you can do. If you don't bring other people into the fold, you're only going to be able to do so much.
That is super fascinating and very timely in that if we think about, you know, we're in this middle of this pandemic, right? Mm-hmm. And everyone is adopting this work from home model. And mm-hmm. I still so vividly remember these, it's not even one moment, it's many moments where companies are now talking about, they're like, you know what? Turns out maybe we can trust our people to work from home when things go back to normal. And I'm like, why did you hire them if you don't trust them?
Yeah. Yep. And that's a huge, huge piece of how teams are successful and something that, you know, we always use sport as metaphor. That's why I love this conversation you and I are having. It goes both ways. You know, people always ask, well, why was that group so special? What was it about that? Well, trust was the huge first step. If you don't trust your people, if you don't connect with people, if you don't focus on them first, your top level of achievement is going to be lower than it would otherwise be. Because again, you know, how do you build a human pyramid? You're going to have a very short one if it's just you, you know, mm-hmm. and everybody plays an important role in that. But you know, it's funny that you bring that up too, because my brother works in the technology sector and I never understood how people didn't need to be together to work as a team or be together to be productive. And the more that he explained to me how teams build projects, you know, remotely, they're interacting just in different ways. You know, they're in their own spaces doing things. They're building their, you know, I tend to be a little more extroverted and my brother tends to be a little more introverted, but I've seen him thrive by working at home and he's interacting far more just in different ways.
Yeah, they're not physically, literally lifting a boat on their shoulder, carrying yep. it down the dock and throwing it in the water, but they're lifting the metaphorical mm-hmm. boat together as they're sort of building something with their own pieces.
Yeah, yeah. And they don't even necessarily have to be in the same office walking down the hallway to do that. In fact, he and a lot of his coworkers just function better without being physically together, even though, you know, they're communicating, like I said, in other ways, mm-hmm. virtually or, virtually.
So then what are the foundations, I guess, of trust in building a team? And that's such a big and abstract question that might even be hard to answer. But if you were just to think of your own teammates and you've been on elite teams with other elite athletes, and there have been other teams in other sports that have had similar collections of elite athletes that have miserably failed because those individual performers couldn't come together as a team. So in your experience, what do you think it is that makes a team great? And how can that be applied even outside of a sports context?
Yeah. It's funny because there are so many conversations that I've had about trust, and people ask that very specific question about trust. And every team is different. That's a big piece of it. You know, you have to recognize the diversity within your culture, whether it is a sports team or a technology team or whatever group of people that you're working with, because that diversity is important. That goes back to the idea of allowing that person to be the best at that piece of it. And that person that, you know, you need to have different people because everybody's going to have a different strength. And recognizing the need for diversity, the importance of diversity, is what you're going to thrive on. That also makes it challenging to communicate well. So one of the first things is foundationally communication and saying, we don't all have to be the same to get along. We don't all have to be the same to work together because we have a common aim. What is our common aim? You know, we use the value and the mission and the, you know, the vision and all of those, all of that language in business, when really, you know, create the words that you want. What's our aim? What are we all here to do? you can be passionate and get behind that without being cookie cutter the exact same people. And when you do that, that helps develop trust. You know, recognizing the importance of everyone that's there develops trust. Addressing and communicating, addressing each person's need develops trust. And behaving, if you're saying one thing, you must behave the way that you're saying. The things that you're asking of other people, you must behave that way. From a rowing standpoint, you know, rowing is this crazy sport because I played a lot of sports growing up, team sports mostly, but rowing is the one team sport that you cannot bring a group of fast people together, throw them in a boat and hope for the best. They can actually go very slow. Individual people that are very good on their own. If someone tries to do something all at once on their own in the middle of the race, it can in fact make the boat slower. They could put in more effort and actually slow the boat down. It requires a willingness to follow and to work together in a very seamless way. And there is, you know, a certain level of setting an ego aside to a certain extent of, okay, this person's rhythm is better. I'm going to go with the way that this is working because it'll ultimately conserve energy in the long run, even if it's different than what you're used to.
So that idea is super fascinating. The idea that you could actually work harder and go slower. And did you talk about that in your book, by the way?
Yeah, I do. All of these things I talk about in the book. You'll pick up on trust and you'll pick up on teamwork and connection and all of the different things. And I very specifically bring up that comment in the book or that topic in the book.
Yeah. So the reason I ask is because, so our books, you know, my book about how to secure software and your book about how to achieve greatness based on your rowing excellence, there's a middle of this Venn diagram, which is this idea. And it's that in technology, this happens all the time. And hopefully this metaphor that is your experience will help people think differently about how we build technology, but it happens all the time. I mean, every day I talk to companies who struggle with this and many of them don't even realize it, that if you build in the wrong way, you to hit deadlines or whatever, oh, we got this release date coming up, then what actually winds up happening in the long run is you actually move slower and you have to put more work in order to fix the thing that if you just had addressed it at the beginning, yeah, it would come out better. And so that's really fascinating. It's the same thing, right? It's like, I'm personally going to row the boat super fast. And the other seven people in this boat, hopefully they will too. But the net result is that you go slower.
You know, and the other piece of that too, is that, one of the first things I learned when I first started studying motor learning many years ago is that whenever you make a change, because change is scary, you know, trying something different is scary, especially if it's been working for you as, you know, you've been successful to this point, you know, doing this thing. Well, to take that risk might make you slower initially. Like you might have to relearn a process, but it's going to open the floodgates down the line. You know, I'm not particularly tech savvy, so I love working with you and you things that you know, you almost take them for granted. I do the same thing in my realm. You take for granted what you know, and you don't realize that it's not common knowledge. But then to take the step back and go, okay, fine, I'm going to take the extra hour or the extra 5 minutes or the extra day to learn this and put all these in a bucket so that all the automated things can happen, you know, and it really just does speed things up in the long run. You know, the idea of communication, it's fascinating because athletics has changed so much with social media, technology, all the things. And there is a big shift into looking at data and all the numbers so that the simple things like trust and communication are starting to get overlooked. It's like, okay, what are your numbers? Okay, that person must be good because they check all these boxes. Well, what about the person that's a really good team player that connects everyone? That really just is the glue that holds everything together. Because there are other behaviors, like being on time to work. That's a simple behavior that person might not have the most sales or the most other metrics, but they're making everyone else show up on time because they're setting that example. And that's a small example of what I mean by some, you're the best. Every person on your team is the best at something. And that right there could be a component that is allowing your team to excel that would be very easily overlooked.
I love it. So one of the things we like talking about here on this show is challenging conventional wisdom. I think almost everything we've talked about so far is you helping us do that, think differently.
Yeah.
If you think back to your own success, either in the boat or coaching or otherwise, or, you know, mm-hmm. pick the realm, what would be one of the primary stories or examples of where you went against conventional wisdom, and what could we all learn from that? Like, what's the takeaway from your experience going against the grain?
Yeah. You know, I love that you ask it right now, because it picks right up on what we're just talking about is, and that's what exploring some of this through writing the book made it even more clear in my mind, because I tracked everything. I kept all my training logs. I journaled. There are things in this book that are, this is what I was thinking in that moment. I literally wrote that in that moment, you know, so you get
like the weather you were saying.
Yeah, the weather, among other things. Of, you know, there were times when I would write things like, I had one of those days today. I even stepped in a puddle on the way to the car. You know, everybody has that day. But people started asking me over time, because I got sick every now and again, but never really sick. I had one little tweak of an injury, but really, to go through an entire Olympic cycle, I spent like 7.5 years uninjured. It took after the Olympics to really get hurt. And that was, we talked earlier about some of the overtraining concepts. But so people started asking me, like, what did you do? It must have been special, because I was actually one of the smaller athletes. I was shorter than, you know, on average. I was not as strong numbers wise on average, but I was able to stay injury free and pass people that were physically bigger and stronger than me. How? It must have been some supplement or some special diet or something that we all think every athlete does. So it wasn't genetic gifts. That's an assumption people make about athletes. Obviously I have some, but I wasn't as gifted as so many others. It wasn't nutrition, like a special diet that I had someone build for me every day. It wasn't a special supplement that I had someone build for me every day. So I realized it was because I did the basic things really well. I didn't overcomplicate the system. I didn't try to search from what's the next new thing that someone is doing. No, I did the most important things to the best of my ability. And I'm gonna guess maybe better than what other people did, you know, and those are things that I actually like to apply. I apply those now to life. They allow me to be productive in life now. If I know I have a busy day, I go, even if all I have is 15 minutes to exercise, I take 15 minutes or 20 minutes and go for a run. It doesn't have to be an hour. Just go do something. I'm more creative. I'm more productive immediately following that than if I just woke up and didn't do it, you know? So the basic things, you know, to debunk the conventional wisdom was sleep a lot. It's not complicated, right? Hydrate, do that better than anybody else, you know, eat very simply and very well, very cleanly, no supplements. It was lots of colors, fruits, vegetables, balance, and exercise. And that allowed me to think better. All of those things allowed me to be physically and mentally more productive. Simple.
It's kind of amazing to be talking about, well, here's how I went against the grain, and it's sleep more.
Yeah.
And eat right and drink water. But you're totally right. Right. Especially in this sort of performance metrics enhancement crazed world that we live in, where we're so focused on, you know, how do I get these incremental, you know, biohacking is kind of a big thing right now in tech, where it's like, how can I feel like I slept for 8 hours when I slept for 4, you know, that kind of stuff. And you're saying, no, it's guys, yeah. It just keep it simple.
Yeah.
That's really
all
powerful.
All the research is there, you know, all the research is there. And then it was interesting, because at the time I just did it because I was tired. I mean, and when I say sleep at that level, when you're training at that level, I mean, I could sleep for 10 hours a night. This is in the Olympic year in particular. I didn't have time to do that in other years, but I would sleep 10 hours a night, and then I could still nap, because you're just that exhausted because you're physically and mentally drained. And that's the one time your body is able to repair from whatever it was that you did the day before. You know, you're making your gains while you're asleep, not while you're training. The training breaks you down the same way that your work day, that breaks you down. So you've got to repair if you want to go back and be productive the next day. It's amazing, because, you know, it doesn't seem like conventional wisdom. That seems like conventional wisdom, but I had teammates that were like, this is my supplement, this is my special thing, these are my extra lifts. And they constantly got hurt. They constantly got sick. So all these very special newfangled things that they were doing were in fact harming them rather than allowing them to advance.
I love it. Keep it simple, recover while you sleep. That's powerful stuff right there. And you're obviously talking about it as an elite athlete, but that applies to everybody, right? Yeah. In our day-to-day jobs and our relationships. And like, we have to have that recovery time. Otherwise we're not gonna be able to perform at a high level.
Yeah. I mean, we all the research is there from a well-being standpoint. It's very well documented that if you're not sleeping at least 5 hours a night, like sleep deprivation studies use 5 hours a night as sleep deprived, you know, or at least a lot of them do. You know, they've done studies where they have people do some sort of test. Like this is, you know, people studying for the GRE. They study and then they sleep and then they take the test. And they found that people with sleep after the practice or study or whatever it was have better scores having the same time gap, but filling the time gap with sleep rather than staying up. Right. So we know that these very simple things make us better. They make us smarter.
Yeah.
I won't digress too much into the science because I mean, we're talking like your brain literally grows.
Isn't that what we want? That is what we want. Yes. And it's not even, it's like, go to sleep and you'll be smarter. I mean, this is great advice.
Yeah.
I still don't understand how it is that someone training to become a doctor, the regimen that you go through when you're in residency, where you basically don't sleep and you have these like 100-hour shifts. And even once you're, you know, the chief or whatever, you still have 48-hour shift. I don't know exactly what the time, I'm not a doctor, but my friends are. And I look at what they go through. I'm like, how are you not sick all the time? How do you not hurt people? And it's just, I guess they just figure it out. But how does someone, I guess, excel despite, you know, when you have a shortage or a deficiency in one area, you don't have enough sleep, how do you make up for it in other areas? Or can you, or is that not a possible thing?
Yeah. I mean, if it's sleep in particular and you're cut on time, you know, assess your schedule. Something I also talk about very explicitly in the book is if you want to be great at something, it's kind of like the Devil Wears Prada concept, right? If you're excelling there and you are literally putting all your marbles over there, then something else has to suffer. And so you have to choose what is most important. You can't be great at everything. You have to focus that down. From a training standpoint, while I was training, it was literally practice, self-care, and work, right? I would go to practice, have a break, go to practice number two, rush to work with like wrinkled pants and wet hair, you know, rush back for practice number three, go home, and then sleep and do whatever you can to take care of yourself to prepare to do it all over again the next day. So you really have to look at what is important and what you're prioritizing. I tell my teammates all the time that really training for an elite sport is a luxury because your job is to pay attention to your body and how your body is responding to things. We don't give ourselves enough credit. We take ourselves for granted sometimes. For me, before I started rowing, I didn't know what it meant to feel rested. I didn't know what it meant to feel super healthy until my aim and literally for what I was doing at the time was to be as rested and healthy as I could be. So then I'm able to reflect on that now where I'm like, oh, I know what it feels like to feel really well rested. And this is not that. So giving yourself that time. And it doesn't mean, you know, if you only have 5 minutes, get the 5 minutes. You know, if you have 20 minutes and you can take a 20-minute nap, do that. But again, first, like assess what you're doing, figure out what you have to do, and then prioritize that and make sure that you're saving enough time for you to prioritize your physical health too.
So let's talk about priorities because I want your input on how to help solve one. I have an axe to grind on certain things that happen, definitely in tech, probably elsewhere. So you can either tell me I'm wrong or dismantle why people think this way.
Yeah. All right.
So we're talking a lot about priorities and we've talked about the ideas of like focus and doing the simple fundamental things right.
Yeah.
And focus is an interesting concept that I see people really struggle with, I think across industries, that we live in this world today where there's notifications going off every second from a gazillion devices, from your watch to your computer, to your phone, to just your home assistants or whatever.
Yeah.
Constant flow of information that we now have to react to. And I've found that
Pavlov wins.
Pavlov, yeah. It's like, oh, I'm going to do this thing. Pavlov wins.
No, I'm sat, right? Salivating. No, let me.
Yes. Yes. Pavlov and his dogs. I love it.
Yeah.
I see people struggle, and probably not even realize that they're struggling with this all the time, where they're like, oh, I have to respond to all this, like it's my boss or my boss's boss, or and some of those are legitimate concerns, right? Like, how do you not answer the boss? Mm-hmm. But what the trade-off is, as in my view, is that you wind up not being able to really dedicate that focus to get deep work done and get the right projects done. That's the kind of stuff that prevents anyone from writing a book. And you and I have certainly been able to sort of clear the runway of the notification runway to do that. So what's your counsel to people, whether they realize that that's their problem or not, but who probably have had, you know, 27 emails come in and 13 text messages and 45 Slacks all in the time you and I've been talking. And that's probably building anxiety to them. They have to respond to it. What do you say to them when it comes to achieving excellence or performance or however you want to frame it?
Yeah, all of those are minute stressors, you know, and you have a threshold. Eventually, it's not going to be the 45 that bother you. It's going to be number 46, and you're going to be fine until for the first 45 of them. But number 46 is going to set you off. And, you know, I don't want to minimize, you know, this, but the more rested you are, the more physically healthy you are, the more stress you're able to manage. You know, and so it's really when it's like that random Wednesday when you haven't had enough to eat and this happens again, and it's been building over time, that stress boils over because you are no longer robust enough to manage it. You know, I would ask from that standpoint is, are all those notifications necessary? And if they are all absolutely critical, are they? Ask yourself again, are they actually necessary? And then maybe have a conversation. If you can quantify that, like if it is actually making you less productive at what you're doing, then there's something about it that isn't actually necessary. So you need to find a way to have that conversation with your coworkers, potentially your boss, to figure that out. Because again, that could be one of those things that really opens up the floodgates over time, where you can be far more productive in the long run if there is a limit on the number of notifications that you're taking on every day. It's also, you know, it's a matter of resources. When I did my EMT, because I do ocean rescue part-time, so I'm an EMT as well. And there's a joke on your first, on your first day of EMT class, there's a joke. What does EMT stand for? But energy, money, and time. Because those are the three things it takes. Those are your resources, right? So sometimes, you know, time is the one that we can't get back. Money comes and goes, time, it just goes, you know, so from a time standpoint, sometimes we pay out all of our debts in time because we don't have the money to bring someone else in on the project. And so if that's a piece of it, you got to ask yourself too, then am I at my limit of scalability right now? You know, until I have some other resource, energy, right, from sleep, or which takes time, you have to kind of figure a way to manage all of that. I think generally this might sound strange, and hopefully this is not me just grinding my axe here, but the pandemic is making us reassess all of this, you know, like which part people are slowing down. And there is like this movement of right now there's kind of been a movement building over time for minimalism and focus. And, you know, I think it's funny when you bring up all the notifications, because here's one that goes right with this is meditation. So meditation has been shown to help your brain grow, you know, it sets your parasympathetic nervous system so you can actually sleep properly and relax. But we put it as an app on your phone. So they're saying meditate before you go to bed because it'll help you sleep, but they're telling you to stay away from your phone because that'll help you sleep. So how does that make sense? Right? Yeah. Yeah. But again, it really is about that prioritization. There is a limit. And if you're noticing that it's distracting you, then you're exceeding the limit of necessity.
So maybe this is the harsh love maybe that people need to hear, which is that, as you just very succinctly put it, right, there's a limit. Mm-hmm. But the harsh love maybe that people need to hear is that ultimately it's up to each individual to put up those boundaries. It's, you know, your boss is going to email you on the weekend, and that important customer and that important investor, and those fires are not going to stop happening because you asked them to stop happening, but our relationship with how we respond to these things, that's the difficult part.
Yeah.
And would you agree that that's who's responsible?
Yeah, it's a huge piece of it, right? Because something that I discovered in my rowing life and then in my, you know, professional life after rowing is what is my basement and ceiling? Like, you know, you can look at it as time, balance, lifestyle. You can look at it as money. Like, you, how do you want to live? What is your basic, what is the basement of how you want to live? And what is the ceiling of that? And for me, once I know my ceiling, if I'm not able to take care of myself from a physical standpoint, because between you and me, no, between all the people that are out there listening, you know, I spent 7.5 years uninjured and then ended up with bulging discs in my vertebrae, you know, and stress fractures in my vertebrae. So that's what we're saying, you know, the shift. So when you do too much, it can all come crashing down on you in a huge shock. And so to find that happen in your personal life, you have to be willing to go, this is what I'm willing to take on, you know, and yes, that will sacrifice, you know, whatever you consider being your measure of success, if it's money or a type of a particular job or whatever that thing is, you have to be willing to set those limits. How do you want to live? How do you want to be? Are you able to be the person you're proud to be every single day? If not, you must reassess.
I love it. I love it. So let's wrap up by talking about maybe overcoming setbacks. In my book, I actually, you will totally appreciate this. I use a rowing metaphor in my book.
Awesome.
Yeah. I talk about catching a crab, describing that as a metaphor. So for everyone who doesn't know what catching a crab is, as you obviously know,
I insert two sentences about it. No, go for it. I want to hear your explanation first.
Oh, wow. So I'm going to be graded on this.
No, not at all.
This is how I described it. And you tell me how close I am. Yeah. But catching a crab is when the water catches the oar at an awkward angle, sort of rips it out of your hands. The oar hits you in the chest, knocks you and the person behind you, and then the boat basically stops rowing.
Yeah. I mean, there are various levels of catching crabs out there. You could just like catch a little edge and it's just a very small one, but then there are crabs that you can literally catch and get ejected from the boat. But yeah, basically it's that something went a little bit awry and your blade got stuck in the water and the handle impacts you.
Right. And so your performance, obviously, at best case scenario, is not as good as it should be. Worst case scenario, you literally lose a rower.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I mean, shoes get ripped out of the boat, you dump somebody, yes. The boat stops, it can turn, there's lots of water going all over the place. So yeah. Yep.
So you've certainly in your career have run into, I'm sure you've probably been on a boat that's caught a crab, but metaphorically you've certainly run into setbacks like you were talking about with even just your injury and everything like that. For people that are listening right now who have run into their own setbacks, maybe their company's not doing as well as they needed to, or maybe the pandemic adversely impacted them, or they lost a major customer, or a key member of their team resigned, or any number of things have really set them back. How should they be thinking about adapting to that and rebounding?
You know, from a setback standpoint, first of all, you're gonna have setbacks. One of the first things is whenever you enter something challenging, admit that it's challenging. That something's gonna happen that is unexpected. Something's gonna happen when you least expect it. And that helps you manage the initial setback, you know, in the beginning. You know, something that I always say when I'm working with athletes is not to think you're gonna catch a crab. Don't focus on the crab, because it's kind of like, you drive toward whatever you stare at, you know, the same thing will happen. You're more likely to catch a crab if you constantly focus on that. You know, maybe having a little bit of practice with managing it and just being open to the fact that anything could possibly happen is an incredible first step there, is to go, yeah, this is really hard. That's why not everybody does it. That way you're not caught off guard by the challenge of it. You know, and from a setback standpoint, it was always relying on those around you. And that's where the communication of it and the trust, that's another reason why trust is such a foundational concept. Being able to communicate with your coworkers, with your teammates, and being able to build and have that be at the core of what you do, is that unity helps you come through.
I love it.
Obviously, I mean, you mentioned, what if somebody, you know, gets separated from the team, you know, you can still have a conversation with that person. You can have a conversation with people that remain, you know, get input from each person as to why that happened, so that you can prepare little steps at a time to build that confidence for the next time that a setback happens.
Right. That's really inspiring, the frame that you just put it in, the way you started that answer, which was that if you're facing a setback, it's because you're doing something hard, and that's admirable, and you should recognize that. So that's what a positive, great way for us to wrap up. You're really good at this.
It's
what,
true.
What are you not good at?
I tell you how I feel, you know, and it's actually funny because, you know, people are like, well, what if you didn't win the Olympics? What if you'd done all of that stuff and then you didn't ultimately win? And I always say, you know, I can't speak to that because we did win, but does it that change every day that led up to the Olympics? No. Every good and bad day, good and, you know, step along the way would still be the same. And I always say, as long as you learn, you know, throughout that whole process, you are never losing. Because you're constantly developing and constantly growing, you know? So you would do yourself a disservice and those around you a disservice if you thought, oh gosh, we had this setback. Man, we must stink at this. No, it's because the thing is hard.
That's amazing. Yep. Get better every day is essentially what you're talking about. And that's, yeah. I believe in that as a, not just a good human principle, but I argue, God, there's so many Venn diagrams of your area of expertise in mind.
This is why we're talking.
This is why we're talking. Yes. That the, I argue that the fundamental premise of security is getting better every day. And if that is not the motivation that someone has, if they're just trying to say like check a box or satisfy whatever customers ask for, then you're never going to succeed. Because that's what security is. You need to be better tomorrow than you are today and better the day after that and the month after that and the year after that and so on. So I love that you could come and be a metaphor for it.
Yeah. You know, and one thing you just made me think of something too is, so when we, the only way that we were able to set and like break the world record was because we trained for things that were faster than world record speed. So exactly what you're saying here about be better than yesterday, we didn't focus on what everybody else was doing. Like, oh, who won last year? Who do we need to beat this year? It was never about that. It was look forward to what has never been done and simply continue taking steps forward. Be better than I was yesterday because that's the only thing I can control is what I'm doing. You don't know what your competitors are doing. You don't know what secrets they have hiding. Are you going to waste your time wondering what those are? Are you going to take all of your energy? This goes back to the notifications. Throw away that distraction. Focus your energy on the thing that's allowing you to take that step forward, right? That is the controllable. That'll take like above and beyond.
that's so powerful, right? Yeah, compete with yourself. You know, ultimately, the race, you are competing with other people, but you can't compete with them necessarily in rehearsal or in practice. And John Wooden, in his book, he talks about how, you know, John Wooden, for people who don't know, is probably, I think, the winningest NCAA basketball coach of all time or something like that. He won like 10 championships. And he talks about he never focused on the opponent, right? Mm-hmm. He always would coach his team to say, don't worry about what the opponent's doing. Don't worry about the scoreboard. If we're better today than we were last season, then we're going in the right direction. And it's certainly evidenced in, you know, you being at the absolute pinnacle of what you've achieved. So that's really cool to hear.
Yeah. Yeah. I a lot of young athletes that I work with find that difficult, especially when you walk into a situation and go, wow, they're really tall or wow, they're really strong. You know, like if I had done that, I would have never excelled because I wasn't, there were plenty of people that were taller and stronger, you know, and that's where it really is because now you're giving yourself credit. This is where I am today. Where can I be tomorrow? Where can I be in 5 minutes? And I guess I shouldn't just say I, you know, it's a, where can we be? And if each individual where can we be? Each individual constituent part of your group that you're working with, when everybody does that, oh my gosh. You can't see my hand gestures out there, but
I know. Let the record show that these big hand gestures are doing it. This is how big it was. Yeah. Well, this has been awesome. You're amazing. You already know that.
Ted, you're amazing. No,
our Venn diagram of amazing is overlapping.
Yes, it is.
So if people want to understand more about your book, where should they find you or find the book?
Yeah, two places. You can find me on LinkedIn and Instagram and those types of places. So you get lindsaydareshoop.com is the website. The book is Better Great Than Never, which is a play on the fact that, you know, I didn't pick up the book until I was 20 years old. Cool thing with the book is, it's all about possibility. So hashtag better great than ever is, what is your possibility today? What are you doing today to be better than yesterday? I would love to see that grow, you know, so.
Awesome. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for being on the show. I think that our audience, their lives are going to be better if they implement some of the ideas. You're amazing and we'll talk again soon. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, Ted. Looking forward to next time.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Tech Done Different podcast with Ted Harrington. If you learned something new and this conversation made you think, then share ITSPmagazine.com with your friends, family, and colleagues. If you represent a company and wish to associate your brand with our conversations, sponsor one or more of our podcast channels. We hope you will come back for more stories and follow us on our journey. You can always find us at the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society.